G'day and welcome to Roaming with Lil. My name is Lil Deverell. I'm an orientation and mobility specialist interested in anything to do with functional vision, orientation and mobility, and the research that helps us to do our job better. Today I'm talking with Liz Skelton, who is co-author of a book called The Australian Leadership Paradox. We're reflecting on what it takes to lead in Australia because that has implications for leadership in the blindness and low vision sector. Hi Liz, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Hi Lil, yes. So to kick off, I'm co-director of an initiative called Collaboration for Impact at the moment and work on how do we develop a way of thinking about leadership and thinking about complex challenges that enables us to address the root causes of a lot of our systems challenges. I've been someone who's been working really on social issues since my 20s at a grassroots level in Scotland, working with young people, drug users, sex workers, gypsies, travellers, people who are normally kind of, I guess, if you like, seen as being on the margin. That thread has really stayed with me. And I think what I've been really doing since my 20s is working on how do we build that bridge between people and ideas who are seen as being on the margins of society and the mainstream, and shifting that power imbalance and really working to get a much more unified view of the world, but also the way that we engage with each other.
So it's really shifting away from a norm-referenced model of culture to validating lots of different ways of being in the world.
Yeah, I think increasingly what we're seeing is, you know, the world's complexity is now becoming more revealed. I think it's always been there, but we're now in an age and living in a way that we can't escape how interconnected we are. So that if we are excluding any group of people or an idea or a person, that then has implications for everybody. The way to tackle and take progress as a society is by really valuing difference, but harnessing that difference, finding ways to work with the fact that you and I might see the world differently. Mm. And in that lies the gold, because we can create something new. If I'm just doing business with myself, then all I'm going to get is business as usual.
I came across your name a few years ago when I read The Australian Leadership Paradox, a book about what do we really have and what do we look for in leadership in Australia. Can you give us a little bit of background? How did that book come about?
So at the time, I was involved working with an organisation, the Benevolent Society in New South Wales, and within Benevolent Society was a small unit called Social Leadership Australia, where myself and my colleague at the time, Jeff Aigner, worked. And we were really fortunate to work with people who were trying to develop leadership all over the country, from citizens, not-for-profits, government at all levels, corporate sector, philanthropy. But the kind of leadership we were focused on was really how do we create leadership for a better world, for a more just and inclusive society. And that was really the exploration in the whole time that I worked there that we were on. So over about 8 years, we explored that through developing leadership in others and with others. Over time, we started to see a number of patterns and dynamics in how people, in their relationship to authority, and what we saw playing out at a political level, but also at an organisational level and at a community level. And we thought, okay, there's something interesting here, that we're seeing the same reluctance or resistance to authority. So what we saw was we were either resistance or defensive towards authority, but there was an inherent reluctance that we saw in people really able to occupy the role of leadership or authority fully. And I guess that was curious. And for me, coming from Scotland as well, I could identify with some of that from in the Scottish context. But what we set out on was an exploration of how does leadership play out in Australia? The paradoxes we identified, you could say, are universal, but they've got a particular flavour and show up in a particular way with a particular language in Australia. So we wanted to share observations but we also wanted to offer some interpretations of that, and then offer a practice, if you like, which is the practice we've been working with and that we saw was able to shift people's leadership practice. Mm. So we wanted something which could kind of do all three, but we really wanted it to provoke a conversation or a dialogue, a bit like what we're having today.
So, yeah. Liz, can you tell us what those four paradoxes are that you've identified in your book?
Yeah, so the first one is that we have a strong anti-authoritarian kind of narrative in Australia, but we're also highly dependent on authority. So we saw a paradox there. The second one is that we have a really strong value in Australia about being egalitarian and that we're all the same and, you know, the idea of the land of the fair go. And at the same time, we're also extremely hierarchical and we also authorize hierarchies. Mm-hmm. So we saw that that was a clear paradox. The third one was around a strong culture about mateship, or if you like, being in relationship with each other, so that we're highly relational and personal in our interactions compared to many other countries at a leadership level. But there's a really strong competitive narrative, which is the shadow side of that, which mm-hmm. we very rarely work on and talk about. Mm. And the final one was that we're a really prosperous country. We have a lot of privilege as a country, as a whole, and we have a lot of abundance, yet there is a story and a narrative about adversity. And what we were curious was, how does that then show up in relation to how people take up leadership?
I think that first one about authority is just intriguing, because the things that spin through my mind are convicts being managed by drunken rum rebellion soldiers who it's very difficult to have respect for in the early days of white settlement in Australia. Similarly, we like to bag our politicians and don't want to put them up on any kind of high pedestal. It's complex. Tall poppy syndrome.
Well, you know, it probably starts before that, because we're talking about trying to take up leadership in a context in a country where the First Nations people of the country were colonized. Mm. And that the impacts of that colonization and that conflict, if you like, of that power being taken from mm. is still with us every day. Mm. Mm. So that's the first layer. And then the second layer on top of that was then, you know, the setting up of a convict colony and the power relationship between the British authorities coming over and the convicts. So it's really steeped and inherent. And when, you know, we've learned from other countries is that, you know, when we don't look to our history, to the mistakes we've made, to try and kind of reconcile those in some ways, then we'll continue to make them. Coming here from Scotland 20 years ago, I also recognised this as being a tension in Scotland. The power was held by the English and that the Scots were the victims of this. Mm. And of course, what's led to is that proverbial chip on the shoulder, being the underdog. And so I recognised it implicitly when I came to Australia. It's nice to be on the moral high ground of being the done to and being oppressed rather than the oppressor. And I think Australia holds a lot of that. So how we see that play out is that idea that authority is something that you do push back against, that needs to prove itself and that we don't trust. And I think that's then really difficult when you're in a leadership role yourself. And you hold that narrative that unless you're working with complete awareness of that, then it's very hard to completely occupy the role of authority. So anybody who does, anyone who stands up and sticks their head up above the parapet, they get a wee bit of time. You know, we pedestalize them first and we have them on the pedestal, and then the pedestal gets a wee bit shaky. There's only one way to go. yes. And I think the reason that we are drawing attention to that, and you know, we're really seeing it playing out at the moment. I mean, pre-COVID, you could say in Australia that the narrative had got to such an all-time low about lack of trust and authority and people in institutions. There was a study done recently, and I saw the figures this week, that Australia was one of the kind of highest countries in the world for the lack of trust in its institutions. And I think that that's got real implications for civil society and how we operate. If we don't trust our leaders in government, in the health institutions, public institutions, accountability, education, the church. We need these to actually function. We need some kind of order. I think COVID has shifted that perhaps in some ways, because I think in Australia particularly, there has been a level of trust in medicine, science, and then the people that espouse that because they've been consistent. So I think this is the challenge we're on, that if we can't trust others to take up leadership, then how do we trust ourselves?
Transparency would seem to be important in the midst of that. Another organisational consultant I was talking with was suggesting that so long as Australians can see the reasons behind a decision, they're more likely to go along with it, even if it isn't what they would choose for themselves.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think there is something about that, that what I've noticed, again, a pattern is that once there is a decision made, people may rail against authority, but when authority then makes the decision, we're actually on the whole fairly compliant compared to many other countries. And again, you can see through COVID that Australia on the whole complied around all the regulations, the shutdown. The majority did, and that's in other countries which maybe have more of an individualistic narrative or paradigm, that's not been the case.
Mm.
People have not trusted authority and they've pushed back against it. So I think this is where the dependence on authority that's particularly high in Australia, even though there's been that mistrust, is where we do see that gap, that we do generally comply once there's a reason for it, once we can see it, then we're actually quite happy for authority to make decisions for us.
Mm.
And so the gap in the middle is actually the interesting part. So if we keep looking to leaders, because, you know, I think John Howard in his time saying to make us relaxed and comfortable really speaks to the heart of the functions of authority about providing direction, protection and order. And I think when people in leadership roles have done that, we see that through the bushfire crisis, they provide order, they provide direction and protection, then we respond really well because they're fulfilling those things around authority. And then we can sit back and relax and know that we are being taken care of. But I think what's important to distinguish is that that isn't leadership, that is authority. And the function, that role of authority is to maintain status quo and to return things to normal and order, which is what we need. I think that's where distinguishing between authority and leadership is critical, because authority we need to maintain what we've got, but actually when we see that we need change, then we need something else. And that's where we need everybody to exercise leadership and not just look to leaders to do it.
Not put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Well, also, I think it reflects the type of challenges we're facing. So on issues where there's a crisis, people in authority can provide that direction and order. They've got the resources, they can mobilise them. It's a different type of challenge. But on other things like, you know, climate change, inequality, poverty, discrimination, which are complex challenges, you actually need everybody who's affected to be involved in that change. It doesn't matter what somebody at the top says, they actually don't have the capacity to solve the problem themselves. So this is where when we just say we want leadership, actually what we're usually asking for is we want someone somewhere to take care of the problem and fix it. But on many of these challenges, you know, it's calling on all of us to go, well, what's our part in this? And how do we play a role? And because with the best will in the world, any person in leadership role can't fix those problems by themselves. They need us to come up with solutions and us to change things and change the way we are doing things.
Which is about a fixed or a growth mindset, really, and a willingness to evolve. The second paradox, the tension between egalitarian and a more hierarchical understanding of where we position ourselves in culture. Tell us how that manifests itself.
Well, I think we like to think of ourselves as being classless. In Australia, the whole idea of the land of the fair go, a narrative about working families and kind of the middle class battlers, if you like. But the reality of that is that obviously there's a kind of growing gap between, if you like, the have yachts and the have nots. You know, I don't know that that is recognised. I think there's the reality and then there's what we espouse. It maybe takes Australians back to a time when that was more the case, when there was far more, the class society, say, from the UK, was less obvious here. But certainly all the statistics would show that that's certainly not the case and that that inequity is growing in lots of ways. And I guess COVID has been a time that's really highlighted that. For many families and many people who are being left behind with it. So I think how we see that that plays out is that it builds more fear and more mistrust. And it means that then when we try and take up leadership in a context where we have this value of egalitarian, we often downplay the power that we've got. So we downplay the knowledge, we downplay the expertise. There's a wee bit of a preoccupation of being in the middle. You know, if we're in the middle, then we're kind of ordinary and we're all just like each other and we're not that different. But as soon as we try and kind of put our head above the parapet, if you like, and show our power or expertise, we know what's going to happen. You know, we fall into then the shadow side of it, which is the tall poppy syndrome. And we get suspicious when we see individual progress or achievement and kind of being afraid to be exceptional and powerful. Now, the only place that I would say the exception of that is in Australia is in the sports arena, where, you know, that is very highly celebrated. But generally speaking, in our civic life, you know, and being in the not-for-profit sector all my life, I would say that that's kind of absolutely the case, that it's very hard to, particularly working in areas with people who have been disadvantaged, then it's very hard to own your rank or your power. So there is a strong narrative of being the underdog or having less power than others. And I guess how we see this playing out, a lot of the work that I do is with First Nations communities or people who have experienced poverty or disadvantage. And when we're in collaborations with people in government or people of power, that those people from communities are often working feeling like they've got very little power. But in the room, they actually hold all the cards. And people in with more formal positions of power feel powerless, even though they hold far more formal power. So I think what it brings out is that power is a very kind of limbic feeling. You know, we feel when we go into a room and we can feel it if we've got less power than other people. We're constantly kind of weighing, where are we in the pecking order here? But it changes. You know, you can be one room in a management role with your staff or with a group of people, and then you go home and then your family, you've got a very different type of power. And it's, you know, what happens when you try and confuse the two. So I think what we see is that because of the egalitarian nature, people do downplay and it's really hard to step into their full power and rank. And what we tend to do to compensate is that we actually build far more structure and hierarchy around it to manage it. So we find ourselves sometimes in really small organizations with multiple layers of accountability and formal power, because we're trying to almost, if you like, search for equality, and we build bureaucracy instead, you know, having a way of working with it and acknowledging it. We create these mazes to navigate. Sometimes somebody's just actually got to make a decision and take up their authority and exercise that.
It brings to mind the guide dog movement started in Australia in 1950. A few people got together and set themselves up in disused tram car in the middle of a paddock, and that was the first office. And I, you know, I love that just get on with it approach to life that makes do with what you have. And then, of course, if you tried to start up a new organisation now, there are so many layers of OHS and government compliance and all this sort of thing. And where do you get your funding from? And I look at structures like the NDIS, quite apart from what its intentions are, the layers of organisation and bureaucracy in order to feed the funds through to the people who need the services and need payment for the services, just so complex.
Again, I think it links to the first paradox around authority, because you know, if we do take up leadership in these contexts and we do provide some direction and authority, then we become more accountable.
Mm.
And we see what happens then when people are in authority role, and we see what we do to others in those roles and the scrutiny that we put them under. So in many ways, it's kind of no wonder that people undersell what they're bringing or overly structure organizations, because actually, if you are the one that is standing up and taking authority, then we see that, you know, it's fairly savage what we do to other people in authority roles. So who's going to sign up for that? We talk about in the book that it's far easier to go to bed at night with complaint than responsibility. It's great if we can outsource all of our complaint about what people in leadership are not doing, because it keeps it really comfortable for us and we don't have to actually take any responsibility for the world that we're living in. We can go, well, that's their role and that's their job. When the kind of challenges we're facing now are ones we've actually all got to step into. And, you know, that's part of the invitation in the book, which is how do we move from being spectators on leadership to participants and seeing the power that we all have, particularly as citizens. You know, we start to see this now around the world, that the power of movements and citizens to really shape how things are going and shape democracies is really powerful. But the challenge is, if we have a narrative that we're powerless, then that's going to keep holding us back.
For me, there's something in there too about visibility and invisibility. I think with the rise of accessibility of video and photo technologies and the use of these in marketing, and, you know, TV being commonplace, whereas 70 years ago it was the radio, it's very difficult as a kid growing up, let alone an adult, to have invisibility where you're out of the scrutiny of adults, you're not being watched by anyone, you're free to make mistakes and recover from them and your embarrassment from them in the privacy of your own world. And then you grow to adulthood and there's so much scrutiny, people watching you from behind lace curtains or in formal positions, and it's very difficult to actually make mistakes and recover from them in private without everything being revealed. Everything is on display, and so it's very difficult to experiment with power, with hierarchy, with that mateship, that egalitarian or sense of equality, and experiment with moving between those roles without having commentary from others. Yeah, and everything kind of being on watch while you try out where to position yourself as a leader.
I think you're right that the kind of complexity now around experimentation and being able to test and try things, which we know is needed if we're going to tackle complex problems. If you think about any of the ways that we've evolved over the years as societies, medicine, science, that's happened in labs where people have been able to run experiments, test and try things, come up with new things. And in a way, if you like, we're in one big lab that we're all in public trying and testing different ways to address some of the challenges we face, but without the security or the holding environment that we would say in leadership, you need to have a container to contain change so that you can make those mistakes, you can test and try, and you can fail, and you can learn from the failure. So I do think, I mean, this is getting into now what's our work in leadership if we're trying to make changes, you know, to think about how do we build a container for this work. Sometimes we are the container, that it's through our relationships, it's who we know, that we're able to hold people through the change.
Mm.
And work with and invite in people who've got different perspectives, so that we're actively seeking diversity and we're making sure that the unusual suspects, people who aren't normally involved in change, are involved in it because they've got a stake in it. And I think, you know, through a lot of the work that I'm doing involved in, is that we're making sure that it's not just the usual experts coming together to figure out how do we fix problems, but that you're involving the citizens in that. You're involving the people most impacted.
Mm.
And they're part of co-creating the solutions. And that without that, all you're ever going to be doing is doing to someone, you know, providing solutions for someone, not doing it with. So I think this is where we need spaces. We need to have a container for change. And maybe with that, and Lil, what you're raising is actually a way of working where we build a tolerance to be able to experiment. That if we don't have cultures in our organizations and in the institutions that we have where we recognize that for some challenges we've got to do experiments and test and try things and learn, then we're never going to be able to move forward because we can't learn. You know, having a culture where failure is not just tolerated but expected, you see in the tech industry, it's actively encouraged because they know that they're going to do a first iteration of something and then that's going to fail in some way, or it'll only have a certain life and then they've got to build on it.
Yeah.
But I don't think in the social sector we're very good at that. We expect that we come up with the right program or the right initiative, and then, like you say, we bureaucratize the hell out of it, and we don't actually make it something that we just know we've got to keep on constantly developing and learning from. So I see that shifting. I see bright spots in places where people are doing that, but they're only doing it by being willing to change the way they're working and take up leadership differently.
It's about good reflective practice, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So that paradox about being relational, mate, and competitive, where do you see that happening most in organisations?
This is a really inbuilt, endemic kind of culture, regardless of sector, and it does tend to be gendered. That, you know, when we talk about mateship, we don't often think about women, we talk about men, and we talk about people using their own networks to engage people. So I think where we see it strongly at the main leadership levels, I mean, you only need to look across the boards of the top companies, look at any leadership table, regardless of sector, they're normally going to be male, white, and of a certain age. And in some sectors, in the social sector, there's often more women there, but there's often, if there are men, they're usually the ones in the leadership roles. So, you know, trying to see boards or leadership tables who actually reflect the communities that they live and work in is quite rare. I mean, it's starting to change slowly, but I think that's where we see the strong culture of mateship. What it does do is, of course, it maintains a certain way of thinking and worldviews and seeing the world. If we keep doing business with people who look and sound like us, then we're going to keep getting the same results. This really goes to the heart of DNA around any society that's evolving, that if it's the same DNA, then we don't adapt. Bringing in diversity here isn't just PC. It's actually more about survival, that we've got to be able to have different ways of seeing what's going on to be able to make progress. The other side to this culture around mateship is that we don't do well with conflict.
No.
If we approach, yes, if that sounds like that's resonating.
We lack a language that is any richer or more complex than slamming the door and walking out. To actually stay and disagree and tease through the tensions in a situation and work out how to move forward takes time, commitment, and understanding that it's actually possible to bring things through to resolution. I don't know that we see it modelled very much in our popular media either. And so it's really difficult, I think, for Australians to know how to move forward in healthy ways that are Australian in style and still able to resolve conflict.
It's a great quality, that relational quality that Australians have around being in relationship, being informal, being able to cut through, you know, and be straight away on first names term, even with someone, regardless of the level of authority they have. I mean, I think that speaks to, again, the paradox about being slightly kind of, you know, the larrikin idea is, you know, I'm going to call you by your first name, even though you, you know, you're kind of senior, worth billions of dollars, which you don't see in other countries. You know, coming from Scotland, I noticed that when I first came here, that you didn't call people Mr. or Mrs. or whatever. It was straight away you're on first name terms with your boss. And that's quite unusual culturally. But I do think that the shadow side of that is this inability to have conflict openly. And how we see that playing out in systems and in cultures and at leadership level is that we take the argument or the conflict outside the room. So it shows up in the corridor, it shows up in the lift, it shows in the car park, before we go into the meeting or after we come out of the meeting. You know, we have the meeting before the meeting or we have the meeting after the meeting to say the stuff that we really wanted to say in the meeting, because we don't know how to bring it into the system. And I think the danger with that is we take the wisdom of the dissenting voice outside of the system. And when that happens, it goes on the resistance line, if you like. And that's where it will start to resist change. Unless we can find a way to bring that role in, seeing that as a role in any issue, there'll be someone who isn't on board. The danger is that many of our systems, it's very hard for us to hear that voice, because what we do, because we see everyone as mates, is we personalize it. And we go, okay, Liz has got a problem with this, so therefore Liz is the problem. As opposed to having a way of working, particularly around some of our more complex problems, which allows us to see and invite in difference and see that as useful, not only useful, but really needed. And I guess I see this most strongly on issues where we're particularly entrenched and polarized, like issues around culture and race, issues around how we work with First Nations Australians, where we find it very difficult to have conflict. So we don't have the argument together. People are terrified to be able to challenge or question for fear of being seen as using power. As a white person working with First Nations communities, what I see very often and have grappled with myself is being able to openly disagree and have that conflict. And yet when we've been able to build a muscle to do it, it's been incredibly relieving to everybody, because we've found a way to break through and to transform what's happening and come up with solutions. So I think that this is a major challenge. And I think you've also said, Lil, when we do have now social media and media which keeps us in our own bubbles, where actually our view is constantly being reinforced and we're only ever seeing news or getting views of people who agree with us, that muscle to have difference is getting a wee bit flabby, you know? The muscle to argue constructively. Growing up in Scotland, where it's a pretty argumentative culture, I grew up in a family where you were expected to argue your case and have difference. And it's okay, you're still staying in relationship. And that happened politically, it happened in the pubs where people would be arguing about, you know, politics or football or whatever it was. And it was just kind of expected. And it's very hard to have that conflict in the open air here. I think there's just a real fear about not being able to stay in relationship and hold the heat. So it ends up becoming polarized quite quickly, or it ends up going underground and it stops progress. The more that we can own our power, it links to the other two paradoxes. The more that we step in and acknowledge the power that we have and use that rather than neglect it, the more that we can actually lean into the argument rather than be scared of it. The shadow side of that is this competitive part, which if we're mates, then how do we compete? We are also very competitive, so we avoid that open competition and we prioritize the relationships over potentially the purpose of the work that we're there to do. And that's where we see often we can lead astray and we can end up on purpose creep, because we don't want to upset the status quo. And we end up spending lots of time tending to the relationship. And, you know, I'm saying this working in the not-for-profit sector particularly, you know, we take up that caring role as opposed to going, is this actually helping us make progress on the work that we're here to do? The more we can anchor ourselves in the purpose of why we're here and what is the role we need to take up, then it means you and I can disagree with each other, because we're doing it from role. We're not doing it from Lil and Liz.
Yep.
It's actually my role requires that I need to look at this through a certain lens, and I'm going to have a different view from you, and that's okay. So let's have the argument and let's see where we end up, and in a different place with something new.
We have a name in our household for this particular paradox, which we call terminal niceness. You can actually die of it. Mm-hmm. Organisations can die of it. Committees can die of it. If you don't embrace and find ways to wrestle with your issues of difference, then nothing really flourishes or blooms.
And I think the other side of that is that it also maintains status quo, that the traditional way that power is showing up gets reinforced.
Yes.
So we're seeing that now with the rise of Black Lives Matters and much more visibility and understanding around the rights of people with disabilities, but also the rights of like people with, you know, from transgender and just the different realities that people occupy. So if we don't have any way of understanding, or we don't bring those voices in to the work that we're doing, then we just continue to get business as usual. Yes, we can get innovation if we bring in diversity, but this is actually about now we're seeing the cost to us all when we do keep excluding and we do keep the current power structure, because it's not sustainable on a whole range of levels.
Mm. And that fourth paradox, Liz, battling adversity and living in prosperity. We are the lucky country.
Well, we have the narrative of the lucky country, and we do have, relative to the rest of the world, you know, a lot of abundance and far more room to move, if you like, than many other countries. But there is a constant narrative about battling adversity. And I think where we see this really play out, you know, we're really, really good at dealing with crisis. When the bushfires are there, when there's droughts, when there's been floods, there's a real kind of community coming together, and we see leadership really shine at those times.
Mm.
There's an inherent understanding about the role of authority. The functions of authority are to provide direction, order and protection, and they really come to the fore in a crisis. It's like, this is what you need to do. This is how we're going to be taking care of you. This is the order that we're putting in place. And we absolutely need that when we're in a crisis. It's been written about in a number of places. We're really good managers of adversity. Mm. And we come together and we really coalesce and get behind people who were battling at the time. But we're the worst managers of prosperity. So I think the challenge that has for us is that, you know, if most of the time many people are living in relative prosperity, then how do we actually start to be future focused, and how do we start to look at some of the more complex challenges that we're facing and really be able to lead, take a leadership role in the world on that, when we do have a crisis focus or a short-termism? We can respond around short-term things, but what we actually don't have is a vision.
Mm.
And a clear sense of what's the type of country that we're trying to be and that we're trying to become. And I think many of these crises give us the opportunity to have that kind of national dialogue about what does this mean and for who we become. COVID was a great example of that, that what we did see was, you know, what's been called radical localism, where we saw people in communities start to take up leadership and organize and look after each other and get organized really quickly to make sure that people who were most vulnerable were being kind of, you know, supported and had connection. That was a great moment. Everyone was then worried about it snapping back to business as usual. In many ways, you could say that we have done that, that we have snapped back, and the government stepped in to maintain a level of security. But the opportunity in this disruption is actually to think about, well, who are we and what kind of country do we want to become, and not be fixed in this kind of narrative about battling crisis all the time, but being able to look ahead and engage people in that vision. And I think we see that playing out at a local level in organisations as well.
Yeah. I mean, we have a language around sustainability, but is it actually something we have a love-hate relationship with because we love the adrenaline rush of a crisis?
Yeah, look, it could be. We know what to do. We know how to respond. I think it taps into that flight or fight thing. It taps straight into that shared humanity, and we know what to do then.
Mm.
On more complex challenges, the challenges around climate, sustainability, inequity, poverty, they're really complex. They require engaging and listening to people who've got different views, and they require us often, I think at the heart of these is we've all got to make some kind of change. Governments don't like to engage people in this dialogue because they're often not going to be popular. We've got to shift our ways of life, and no government gets voted in when they start to talk to the population about the changes we've all got to make. So I think it's just much harder. And often people in those roles find it far easier to lead through crisis than they do to lead in complexity, because the problem continues to continue and you've got to keep that constant engagement and test and try and get things wrong and fail. And we don't have a leadership language which will allow for that at the moment.
Nice.
So I think this gets to the heart of what we were trying to advocate for in the book, in the Leadership Paradox, and in the work that I'm doing, which is that we need a new language and a new way of thinking about leadership, which is that this model of one leader who's got the answers and is going to show us the way is really outdated. It belongs to a time that didn't have the complexity and the uncertainty that we now have. The more that we can think about a leadership practice that all of us can exercise leadership every day in our families, in our workplaces, in our communities, by challenging the norms, by pointing out when we are just engaging with the usual suspects and we're excluding people, by, you know, kind of being willing to name the elephants in the room and draw attention to what's stopping us living our values. These are all leadership moments, and I think the more we build that muscle rather than look to somebody to fix it, then that means we've got more chance of being able to address complex problems, because we see that we're all part of it. We're all responsible and we're all connected and we all play a role, rather than that there is some one person out there who's got all the answers who can fix it. I think it's a lovely fantasy, but it's actually not helping us move forward.
I had fun doing some deep thinking about 10 years ago about the nature of charismatic leadership. So if you look at the definition of charisma, it's a gift from the gods or God. And so if you look at the Greek notion of charisma, it's very much about bestowing particular gifts, specific gifts, on a heroic leader who steps in to rescue people with their special powers. And we see that in the plethora of Greek gods who have their particular skills. And then if you look at the Christian notion of leadership, the gifts from God are not bestowed on one particular person and can be seemingly a little bit invisible, because they're not manifest as heroism. They're manifest as what builds up the wider community. And so the evidence of that gifting is in a healthy community rather than a singular leadership. And I think that's what you're talking about with participation of everyone, not necessarily in the same ways, but in rich ways that help the community work together.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely description. On the day-to-day level, we all see the world slightly different ways. This is really, I guess, that invitation to step into the leadership that is there in everybody, but we may not call it that, you know. I'm often working with people in communities and they've never ever thought about themselves as leaders. And, you know, when I kind of speak to them and they tell me what they did to get something off the ground in their community, and I talk about the multiple acts of leadership they perform, they go, no, well, I was just doing what needed to be done. When we are basically helping each other face the new realities that we're in, because we're changing all the time, that's an act of leadership. It's how do we actually mobilize people around us to face a new reality and help us all adapt? We can do that every day with our families and our friends.
All that unspectacular stuff that cumulatively builds something quite magnificent.
Absolutely.
Thanks to Liz Skelton for joining us today. Liz is co-director of Collaboration for Impact, a national not-for-profit network that builds capacity in people to work on systemic challenges and the structures that hold us stuck. You can contact Liz via her website, collaborationforimpact.com. You can also find a summary of this episode in the PowerPoint on my website, www.lildeverell.net/resources. You might like to ponder what kind of leadership you offer to people around you and whether it helps to build a healthy community as you keep roaming.